What were some of the things you found about Dover that was fascinating or different than life in either Boston or Rochester?
Well, for one thing, it the Mason-Dixon line, as you know, goes through Delaware, and while Wilmington is most like Philadelphia, I think Dover takes much of its flavor from the below the Mason-Dixon line. Now, there's definitely a southern flavor to it, and for a for an unrepentant Bostonian, it was quite an experience. Outlook of people and the social mannerisms of people, their interests there. I remember the shocking thing to Rona and to me was when we went to parties there, we found that there were two subjects that people seemed to concentrate on in their discussions. One was how to kill things, and the other was how to cook what they killed. Everybody hunted, and I said about half the talk was how you shot these various poor creatures, and the other half was how you cooked what you shot.
But you had horses there.
We had horses, and this had been a love of mine since I was about 8 years old. I had loved horses. As a matter of fact, when I was in graduate school, one of the ways I made money, I believe for two summers, was as a riding master at Camp Robin Hood in the Maine, New Hampshire border. So I had a love affair with horses that was unrequited until we went to Dover, where we were able to get enough land to have a pasture, and I had a barn built by some wonderful Amish carpenters down there, and we had two horses all the time we were down there.
So that was fun.
I enjoyed it immensely. I thought the boys would love it, Jesse and Lauren, but as it turned out, while they were very dutiful about feeding them in the morning and evening, they didn't really
take to riding.
Right. And I really loved being around them, and Rona accused me of preferring to stay out of the stable shoveling manure to staying in the house.
Well, while you were in Dover, your company, International Latex, developed the space, the suit that they used. And so you had many opportunities to go down to Florida to... you saw some of the...
All of them, really all of them. We made all the suits on the Apollo program, the lunar program, and including those that walked on the moon and that did the first spacewalks, and I attended every single launch, of a crew on the Apollo program, and it was one of those things that people often describe as something they would not give up having done for anything, but wouldn't want to do again for anything.
Why?
Because of the nervous strain, the tremendous tension of each flight. Mm. And every time one of those huge rocket systems would take off, as I watched it down there, and the earth trembled, truly, this word awesome is overused today, but that truly is an awesome sight, an awesome experience to be there close to a launch. And every time I used to think that a piece of me was going up and would never come back, that the astronauts would come back, the suits would come back if all went well, but a piece of me went up that wasn't going to come back. And it was an accomplishment of which I'm still very, very proud. It is an accomplishment of which I'm still very proud. I'll confess to that, because we never lost an astronaut. We never had an accident on the moon or in space.
And
we
your suits never worked had a perfectly.
Failure, you know, never had a failure. And not only that, we never held up a launch. Mm. We never delayed a launch. So it was very exciting, and I stuck with it through the whole program. The last flight was December 1972, and that was the time after which I resigned as president and went on to other things. Mm.
And so you moved to Wilmington?
Moved to Wilmington in 71 because, and I probably should have done it sooner, we had the headquarters down in Dover, which with all its advantages, and there really are some wonderful things about Dover and about the people down there. I enjoyed it very much. But one of the wonderful things is not transportation. In order to get out of Dover, unless you fly private jets, which we did a lot, out of Dover Air Force Base, unless you do that, you have to drive to either the Philadelphia Airport or the Washington, D.C., or the Baltimore Airport. So no matter which way you go, in those days, it was about 2 hours' time to get a plane. And the nearest railway was the one in the Wilmington Station, which was over an hour. So it was really difficult to move around.
So from the standpoint of logistics,
yes,
Wilmington was better.
And so in 71, which is probably 5 years later than it should have been, I moved the headquarters up to Wilmington and we moved here. But that was really toward the end of the period I stayed there.
And so since you've been in Wilmington, what work have you been engaged in now?
Well, starting in January 73, I guess, but the last Apollo flight was December 72. So starting in January 73, I organized my own consulting firm, really a one-man consulting firm, in which I pulled in associates as I needed them, and concentrated on what probably strikes many people as an odd field to be interested in, but concentrated on the problems of companies that are in financial or operational difficulty. It's the business equivalent of battlefield surgery, I would say, because you find semi-corpses, if you will, things where you don't know whether you can salvage them or not. And the challenge is to see, is there a way to salvage them? Is there a way of stitching it all together again and making something whole out of it? And I found this fascinating for some weird reason. Remember, this is a long way from the guy who wanted to do theoretical research in physics and teaching back in the late 40s. But it did fascinate me, and I loved it, and did it quite actively until, it'll be 5 years ago this coming Rosh Hashanah. The reason I can place it so accurately, this would mean it would be the fall of 83. So I've been at it about 11 years.
Well, you said 83.
73 I started, January 73.
No, you, 73, right.
Yeah, January 73 I started it, and it was about September or thereabouts, 83, that I started thinking about the fact that I was no longer getting the kick out of it that I did before, and that after 11 years of that, some of the exhilaration and fun I'd gotten wasn't there. And I must say, I'm embarrassed at how much I enjoyed all these things, the time at Bausch & Lomb and the search. Even the movie industry and the electronics industry and the space program, all this that I refer to now as tinsel not worth anything, was nonetheless tinsel that I enjoyed, I confess. But suddenly, and I also enjoyed the 11 years of consulting and just ate it up. I was ready to rush around, do anything. But suddenly it started, I remember, the reason I can place it so accurately was during the Yom Mim Noraim, during these days of awe between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, when it's our tradition as Jews that we examine our lives. We take a cheshbon ha-nefesh, an audit of the soul, an audit of the being, an audit of the spirit. And at that time I decided, I really don't get a kick out of this anymore, and I want to phase out of it. So starting something like September, October 83, I decided I was going to phase this down and increase. I had been doing some studying all along, but I wanted to increase the amount of studying and decrease the amount of working, and that's really what I've been doing since 83, about September, four and a half years.
Mm-hmm. So that really brings me in down to the question about the role of religion in your life and the importance that it has played.
Well, As I said earlier, the four main elements in my life, I know my father, my mother, my wife, and my identity as a Jew. And I don't use the term religion because, as we both know, Judaism is so much more than a religion. It's a way of life and a way of living. And it's fascinating to me that my life really came full cycle. It started off with a deep commitment to religion and to study when I was a boy, as I indicated. I didn't mention it earlier, but I davened regularly. I laid tefillin every morning. I studied intensely up to the time that I entered Harvard. You remember I mentioned that I took tutorial to them. Then I went to Harvard, and as often happened in that period anyway, I became a wild-eyed radical. I don't think anybody at Harvard in those years was other than a wild-eyed radical. And became, I don't know what I was. I don't think I was an atheist, but I was certainly an agnostic.
Now, how did you, I just want to deviate, how did your parents take to your radical ideas?
Painfully, okay. I would say, because my father, Baruch Shalom, was a very conservative Republican and a man with Yirat Shemaim, or of heaven, was a God-fearing man. And the idea that I would, bad enough that I voted for Franklin Roosevelt,
yeah,
but worse still that I would be a Karl Marx type and,
yeah,
and an agnostic and everything else, and would argue with him about God and about everything of that sort.
Yeah. So you,
it was painful. I don't know how he ever put up with me.
So you deviated now from your religious youth, and you were telling me you're now in Harvard and you were...
Yeah, and terribly so, and that continued while I moderated. By the time I got out of Harvard and into graduate school, I came a little bit back on balance. But even when Rona and I were first married, 1950, she will confirm if you speak with her that I was really a very much a liberal thinker. And of course now she thinks I'm a little to the right of Attila the Hun. But I was definitely a liberal and socialist in my orientation still then. And but I didn't really come back, I must say, which is interesting to me, didn't come back to a passion for study, Judaic studies, until quite a bit later. I would place it as sometime in the mid-60s. So really there was a hiatus there of two decades. Good two decades, and if I look back on it, it was a lot of foolishness. I was wrapped up in my own strivings and seekings and my own ego about how smart I was as a scientist and how smart I was as a manager and all the foolishness that one gets into in those periods. That really, as I look back on it, I feel quite embarrassed about. In fact, it's sort of interesting to me that the things that show on my dossier when someone asks me, when they ask me to be a trustee of something, some committee or something, and they want publicity, and they ask me to give them a bio or a dossier, and I pull out what I have there and I look down, it's really, really almost embarrassing to me because it's, as I said, best metaphor I can think of is it's a bunch of tinsel. It's nothing. But it's along with the tinsel meant I was so blinded, I guess, by that, to stick with that metaphor, so blinded by the light of the tinsel that I lost sight of what was really important. So it wasn't until I think the mid-60s in Dover that I started coming back to want to study some. And then that intensified magnitude until now. I think probably I'm spending 20 hours a week studying. And it just groans over the past, what's that, mid-60s, over the past 20 years.
So it's very satisfying.
Oh, it's extremely satisfying. One of these four major elements that defines me. And it's not just religion, that's why.
It's a way of life.
It's a way of life.
Yeah.
I think that one defines himself as a Jew by study, by this continual striving to reach toward God, to understand Him, to try to understand this relationship, not only between me and man, but between man and God.
And how about the presence of the State of Israel? It also has had an effect in your activities and the direction of your life.
Of course, it changed all our lives. So I think that one can draw a line, as I think I've written as well as said, that one can draw a line in time between those of us who grew up before there was, who were knowledgeable, old enough to be knowledgeable, to know what was going on before there was a State of Israel, and those who, by the time they knew what was going on, lived in a world where there was a State of Israel. I, for example, grew up, my first knowledge of what was happening in the world, see, I was born in 25, and maybe in the early 30s, at about the age of 7 or 8, you start to understand a little bit about what's going on around you in the world. And that was 1933, say, that was 15 years before there was a State of Israel. And it was that terrible world of the gas chambers, that terrible world of Jews being slaughtered, terrible world of Jews having no home, of Jews being a hunted and haunted people, of Jews obtaining survival at the price of wheedling and the price of currying favor. And this all, of course, changed with the birth of the State of Israel. And in Yirtzeh Hashem, God willing, it will never change back.
But you talked about when you grew up in Milton, there was anti-Semitism, and although it really, you said, didn't touch you, you know, it was that time. Mm-hmm. And did you have what they call a ghetto complex? I mean, in terms of the State of Israel afterwards, you know, could you see that there was a difference?
Well, first of all, let me correct one thing. It's not true that I was untouched. I was very much touched physically as well as emotionally. First of all, every time Easter comes today, I get a strange feeling when I see the word Easter in the newspapers. Easter sales and Easter parade. The word Easter to me has all sorts of bad connotations, because that was the time of year when the priests would stir up the, particularly in the Roman Church around Boston, would stir up people about the Jews having crucified Jesus. And I remember as a little boy the terrible experience of being knocked down and kicked around and being called a Christ killer. Well, I was young enough, I don't know how old I was, but I was young enough so I didn't know what a Christ killer was. I didn't know what a Christ was, and I certainly knew I hadn't killed anybody. And I remember going home and crying and asking my father, late in the afternoon, he'd be at home, asking him, my mother being all upset, I was bruised and everything, and trying to wipe me off, cleaning me up, and I was sobbing, asking my father what was a Christ killer. And I remember the awful look in his face as he tried to explain to me what was a Christ killer. I remember the feeling of resentment and anger that welled up into me, that how could anybody possibly blame me for something that happened 2,000 years ago that I had nothing to do with it? I didn't even know who this person Christ was. I'd never even heard the word. And that I should be knocked down and kicked around for something that happened 2,000 years ago that I didn't even know existed was so enraging to me and so frustrating. And it was something that I will never forget.
But did you develop a complex because of it?
Well, I don't know what you mean by a complex. I never ended up being other than proud of my Jewishness, because I grew up in a home where there was pride in Jewishness, where there was never any attempt to hide it, and I never had any misgivings but that as a Jew there was something better about me, in the sense of my opportunity to do good things, my opportunity to be a light to others. Never in the sense that I was entitled to something more than others, but that I was chosen to stand for something important. So I never had a complex, I forget what term you used.
Ghetto complex.
A ghetto complex in the sense of feeling inferior. Heaven knows, not at all. But I did have a complex, if you will, use that term, concerning the alien world of the Gentiles. I knew I was different, and I knew that they weren't comfortable with me, and after being kicked around a few times, I wasn't, of course, very comfortable with them. And I must say that while I've spent most of my business career with Gentiles, I've not worked in Jewish companies. Most of the people with whom I've worked, who've worked for me, and whom I've worked for, and whom I've worked with, have been non-Jews, and I've enjoyed these relationships, and I can honestly say I can see no instance in my whole career of ever having suffered from anti-Semitism, including that first job in Bausch & Lomb, the old German company. But I was always keenly aware that there was a difference between me and the Goyim, and that I always had the feeling, which some argue against, that if I were to scratch a little bit deeply between the surface, I would find an anti-Semitic layer in any one of them. That I was accepted in a way, but only so far.
So it didn't apply to your social life, but in your business life, you felt you were accepted.
Oh, yes. In my business life, I never felt that I was discriminated against. I felt, though, that socially, they felt I was different, and I felt I was different.
Yes.
And I really never sought to be part of any of their social activities. For example, never wanted to be into one of these clubs, I guess there are one or two like that in every city, where 99% of the members are not Jewish, and that the only Jews that are allowed in are the ones who are allowed in by virtue of their position. And in various times of my life, when I was running a company or a major piece of a company, and I was had opportunities to be part of such clubs, I never really wanted to be, because I felt that if I was in by virtue of my commercial or industrial or business accomplishment or title, then I was not because of who I was as a person, I didn't want to be in it. So I've always felt keenly that there's a difference, that the I believe what it says in the Havdalah service, that God did make a difference between us and the other people. And I think the differences are important. And differences don't mean that we have to hate each other. Differences don't mean that we can't work with each other. Differences don't mean that we can't help each other and do all sorts of constructive things together. But there are differences. And there are certain things that we can't do and shouldn't do with each other. And
So in that sense, if you call that a ghetto complex, I have a ghetto complex. But never, because I want to stress this because there's so much of it around today, never did I have a feeling of self-hatred.
Or inferiority.
You know, inferiority.
Yes. While we're talking about your various activities, you have been a member of or in chairman of or been working for a plethora of organizations, activities in your life. And if I would like to ask you if you could just go back and select some of the organizations that you work for or things you've done for the community that have been very meaningful to you. I know that's a large order.
Well, I guess you're looking for community activity.
Yes.
That's a difficult long list, but I've been, I guess, part of a lot of different things. That's part of this tinsel I referred to that doesn't have much meaning, but I was, I won't do these in chronological order.
That's
because
right.
I don't have them written down, but just to run over some of the highlights, I was president of the, then the United Fund of Central Delaware when we were in Dover. At that point, what's now United Way was split into three county United Ways. I was president of the Central Delaware one that included Kent County. In fact, I guess it was when I was president of that that I merged it, got through the vote to merge with the Northern Delaware, the Newcastle County one, so that now United Way includes used to be called United Fund, that includes Newcastle and Kent. I was, I guess, chairman of the Kent County Theater Guild, of all things. I've been a trustee of the Franklin Institute for maybe 12 years. And that I found very enjoyable, by the way. It's a wonderful institution. I was chairman of the Urban Coalition. That's one my good friend of over two decades, Hal Haskell, got me into. When Harry G. Haskell was mayor, mayor of the city of Wilmington, he formed an urban coalition throughout the country. A third of whose members were white, and a third black, and a third Hispanic. And the idea was to have people talk together rather than fight with each other and try to at least maintain lines of communication. I was on the board for several years, and I don't know the dates exactly right, but I think it's pretty close. Perhaps 71 to 72, I was chairman of the board of the Urban Coalition, which was a fantastically difficult job and in many senses an unrewarding one because it was so difficult to make any headway. And some of it was got to be quite violent. I remember a street activist who's been brought up on assault and battery charges on many occasions, a man by the name of Hicks Anderson, William Hicks Anderson, throwing an oak chair at my head in the YWCA during the meeting because after the rant had been raised for about 5 or 6 minutes, I thought we ought to turn to somebody else and let them speak. And, he said, "Don't you turn your back on me, you mother blank, and threw a chair at me." And Brow McCoy, the then chairman of the DuPont Company, who was on the board, yelled, "Duck!" Blessed be he. And I clenched and it went sailing by me. But it was not a very rewarding experience because it was such an acrimonious one. But I think that when I used to complain about it, I always would come to a conclusion to myself that it was at least giving people a place to talk. And even when he threw the chair at me, it was better than if he went out and led a riot. And even Hicks Anderson was reasonably constructive when things got really bad in the streets. So that was a job I held. I've been president of the Jewish Federation of Delaware, as you know, served 2 years in that post, a general campaign chairman back in, I think, 1976. I've been on the life member of the Federation Board, and I've been on the Quits Home Board, and I've been on the Admissions Committee at the Quits Home, and I've been on the Board of Jewish Community Center. I've been on the Board of Albert Einstein Academy and was president of the Academy for a year. And on and on and on and on.
Don't forget the Jewish Voice.
Oh, I've been on the Jewish Voice Committee, for loads, many years. How many years? Maybe 8, 9. I know I've been writing.
And you've been writing?
I've been writing a column every 2 weeks for 8 years. I looked up the columns now. I've been going for 8 years. And it was also during this period, particularly the period when Russell Peterson was governor of the state of Delaware, I was involved in a lot of committees for him. And I was chairman of the Governor's Council on Science and Technology. And actually, as a subcommittee of that council, I started the Solid Waste Disposal subcommittee, which led to the solid waste disposal facility we now have in Delaware. And I was part of the Coastal Zone Task Force back in the late 60s, which led to drafting the coastal zone legislation that Delaware now has. And in fact, I guess Bill Gaither, who was then dean of the College of Marine Sciences at the University of Delaware, Bill and I drafted the material that Senator Andrew Knox, Andy Knox, introduced that became the coastal zone law.
Well, that sounds formidable.
And I guess the State Planning Council I was on then, and the State Education Council, and all tinsel.
Well, not tinsel, because you obviously have served your wider community very well. I want to get back to your family, your wife and your children. And you told us that you met Rona in Rochester, and you told us that she has been a wonderful companion. I wonder if you'd like to tell us something in terms of your family life, your children, your grandchildren. Now you're in a new stage of life. It's been obviously a meaningful experience becoming a grandfather.
Well, let me back off, if I may. I hate to break whatever script you have there, but I didn't talk about my mother.
Oh, yes.
Aleha Shalom, and she had such a great effect on me. I would like to say a few words about her, because she explains a lot about me. My mother died in 1960. She was a beautiful woman, not just physically beautiful, though she really was that too, but she had a transcendental beauty about her. She had a sweetness and a grace, I guess is the only word I can think of. She had a grace about her that just made a room light up. That's not my opinion, it's that of everyone who knew her. She would walk into a room and it really was filled with grace. She was an ardent Zionist, more than my father was. My father was back in the 30s not as convinced as she was about Zionism. And back in the 30s, American Jews were worried about hyphenation. Gerald L. K. Smith was screaming about hyphenated Americans, and that you shouldn't be an Italian American, Jewish American, you should be an American.
It was the melting pot syndrome.
The melting pot period, and Jews were very sensitive about it. And my mother's sister's husband, who was just an ardent patriotic American, he wore, I remember, a little enameled American flag in the buttonhole. And he used to argue against Zionism. And my mother, who was such a gentlewoman, always. I remember the only time I ever saw her lose her temper and become passionate and was in an argument with him once about the state of Israel. It wasn't the state of Israel then, it was Palestine she was talking about in the 30s. just stating with compassion that it almost, it really shocked me because she didn't get that excited in front of people. She was such a gentle woman. But saying that Jews have to have a homeland, they have to have a place to go, and that whatever the costs were, whatever the consequences were, there had to be a homeland for the Jewish people. And she saw that with a burning zeal, with a burning passion, back when most others didn't. Matter of fact, her commitment and Jewish identity, I guess, is evident in my name. Who in the 1920s, as I said, I was born in 25, who would call a little boy Nissen Asher Finkelstein? The Nissen would become Norman or something like that, Nicholas maybe, but not Nissen. And then to really add insult to his injury by taking the middle name of Asher, it was a phenomenon. And I'm told that my aunt, my mother's sisters, she was one of five sisters, were up in arms about that. How could you, say, I'll admit it later, how could you call a little boy born in America, in the city of Boston, Massachusetts, or Milton, Massachusetts, how could you call Nissen Asher Finkelstein? And she insisted, because she loved my grandfather, my father's father. That's another whole tape for me. He was a remarkable man, my paternal grandfather, my name for. One of the first Jews in Boston. I think there were only less than 1,000, fewer than 1,000 Jews in Boston when he came in. She loved him, and his name was Nissen Asher, and she said there could be no better name than the name he bore, if I would be the sort of man he was. That was what she hoped for. But it tells you a little bit about her.
Yes.
She would insist on that name. But today, calling people by Hebrew names is no big deal. But I'll tell you, in 1925,
yes,
it was something. So she was a remarkable woman in many respects. And her just amazing grace and amazing sweetness, really, and idealism and belief in what life can be and what people can be has been a strong influence on me. She never could see the unclean. She would look at something and she always saw beauty in it. And she really influenced me. Again, I will never be up to her standards as I will never be up to my father's, but she taught me, and I wish I'd learned it better, to see the beauty even in ugly things and to look for the beauty. She was the quintessential example of what tradition teaches about the dangers of the evil tongue, because she would never have an evil tongue. You would never say anything bad about anybody. This is a digression, but it's
no, it's not a digression.
It's a very determining factor.
Yeah, well, she must have been a role model for you, and
in many ways.
Yes. Well, obviously, you're a byproduct of her teaching. So
no, a really, and this is not false modesty. It's just factual. Only a very faint reflection of either her or all of them. But as for Rona. You asked about her and about children,
yeah,
and grandchildren.
Let's start with Rona.
All right. Wonderful place to start, because that was of all the decisions I've made in my life, and insofar as I made that decision, and of all the blessings that God has given me in this life, that's one of the greatest. They're the only ones that match it, on my mother, my father, and my Jewish identity. Because